Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, February 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Saratoga Hospital, introducing the Center for Wound Care and Hyperbaric Medicine at its Wilton Mall location at its new Hyperbaric Chamber program, saratogahospital.org. Joining us for Medical Monday is radiation oncologist Dr. Tia Olds of New York Oncology Hematology. If you have a question for Dr. Olds, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Tia Olds and your oncology questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. Tia Olds. Dr. Olds is a board-certified radiation oncologist at New York Oncology Hematology, currently treating patients at NYOH's Albany, Patroon Creek, and Clifton Park locations. She has a passion for helping patients advocate for themselves and understanding their power in healthcare decision-making. If you have a question for Dr. Tia Olds, give us a call right now. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number, or you can call. No, you can call that number. You can email voxpop@wamc.org. That's the email address, voxpop@wamc.org. The number is 800-348-2551. Now that we have that sorted out, welcome Dr. Tia Olds.
Hello, Ray. How are you?
Good. How have you been?
Oh, not too bad. Thank you.
That is very good. Before we get to our calls today, I wonder if you have been on a couple of times and we've talked about what it is you do as a radiation oncologist. And I find it really fascinating about how you basically shut down or destroy the DNA in the bad cells. And sometimes that takes some time. But let's just educate me about lifetime dosing limits on radiation. In other words, you know, We all have x-rays from time to time. Some of us have radiation oncology. There are limits, right?
Absolutely. There are total body limits, which usually tends to drift into the area of diagnostic radiology. So total body limits are something that you consider when someone's getting a CT scan, what part of the body is actually being imaged. If they're getting some type of procedure that requires fluoroscopy, which is kind of lifetime x-rays, if you will. Mm-hmm. So those are things that you're concerned about in terms of total body radiation and total dose. And there's been a tremendous move in this country to reduce the amount of radiation that you're receiving to different body parts. So a lot of imaging facilities, right on the report, will tell you that low-dose CT guidelines were utilized in imaging. So they're using as much radiation as needed to get good quality images for diagnosis. When it comes to radiation therapy, it's a little bit different because we're talking about specific body parts. Every part of your body, every organ, has a certain tolerance to radiation. So those things are obviously considerations when we're talking about treating any part of the body with radiation therapy.
So when you have, let's say you have oncology, you have radiation oncology, and you have a treatment, prostate, and then down the road, you have something in the neck or the head that also requires this. There is enough distance between those body parts for it to be okay?
Yes, that's correct. They are far enough apart that you're not going to have overlap between the radiation that was given to the pelvis and radiation that's happening in the head or neck. That's correct.
Interesting. I mean, how did you, not you personally, but how did science reach those limits and figure out the boundaries, as it were?
So the historical component of radiation oncology I find personally fascinating. Often in the early 1900s, there was really no concept of dose, how much was enough, how much was too much. So literally people would come in to get different areas of their body treated. And, you kept receiving treatment until you decided not to come back in many cases. So those decisions were largely made on side effects and toxicity. These sources were live sources, so you had a lot of skin damage because of that. So the hope was that when you didn't return because you had so much skin reaction and irritation, the hope was that the disease had responded. Unfortunately, the correlation was made between those skin changes and disease control, which we know was a bit of a falsehood.
Dr. T. Olds joins us on this Medical Monday. Dr. Olds is a radiation oncologist at New York Oncology Hematology, and our number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question, this email came in from Tamara in Mechanicville. And Tamara wants to know, what are some of the best creams to soothe skin burned by radiation therapy? Are there any specific ingredients to avoid? And that's from Tamara.
So you want to keep things as simple as possible. So you want to, as best as possible, avoid things that have large amounts of alcohol. You want to avoid fragrances as well, just because they have a potential for causing a local irritation. You don't want to do anything that's going to compound any skin changes that you may receive as a consequence of treatment. We're big fans of aloe vera in my practice. Aloe is fairly widely available, not particularly expensive. And I've had a rare number of people that are actually allergic to aloe. So that's something that we tend to stick with. So keeping it basic and simple, stay away from a lot of added fragrances. Often if you can't pronounce the compound, it's probably not something you want to use.
Is it common for patients to have burned skin?
It depends on the part of the body that's being treated. So things that are a little bit deeper set inside of the body, you tend to have less in the way of skin irritation. But things that are a little bit more superficial or things that are directly below a skin fold, for instance, you can have skin irritation there because it's a high friction area, skin against skin, skin against clothing.
Right. Our guest today, Dr. Tia Olds. Let's go to the phones and at least grab one or two here before the first break. The number is 800-348-2551. Rod in New Paltz. Rod, you're first. Go ahead.
Thank you. Doctor, how effective is radiation oncology on the lungs? I know it's the lungs are moving all the time. So is it troublesome to key in on that? Thank you.
Oh, yes, you're welcome. So if you have a cancer that's involving the lung, certainly the lungs, as you mentioned, are moving, right, as you're breathing. So that is something that thankfully with advanced technology we're able to compensate for so that we're able to encompass the respiratory cycle in our treatment process so that you're limiting the amount of normal lung that's being treated. Certainly it's not a perfect process, but technology has allowed us to be a lot more sensitive to that.
Well, thank you very much. That's great. A great, great comment. Thank you so much, Doctor.
You're welcome.
Rod, thank you for the call. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Tia Olds is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Jim is in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
How does a linear accelerator differ from cobalt in terms of safety?
I'm sorry, how does a linear accelerator vary from?
As opposed to cobalt machine,
cobalt.
As far as safety goes.
Gotcha. So safety-wise, a linear accelerator is going to have more in the way of being able to shape the beam that's being delivered. It also has the ability to provide different energies of radiation. So the higher energies tend to be what we call more forward peaked, meaning that you don't have a lot of side scatter from that beam that's higher energy. It's a little bit of a cleaner beam. So that tends to be desirable when we're talking about most therapies. There's some rare exceptions to that. But that's kind of the main difference, that you're able to get high energy beams to where you want to treat. You're able to use different energies. The higher the energy, the more penetration, if you will, to what you're trying to treat. Cobalt, you know, is kind of a set energy, tends to be a little bit more difficult to shape the beam. I'm making a generalization there. And it's more superficial. So cobalt is certainly something that can be used with more superficial tumors. The trade-off is that you do get more in the way of skin reaction.
Jim, thank you very much for the call. We have to take a quick break here. Dr. Tia Olds joins us on this Medical Monday. It is radiation oncology today. If you have a question, 800-348-2551. 2551 is the number. We'll be right back. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Tia Olds, who is a radiation oncologist at New York Oncology Hematology. And we go to Howard in New Paltz. Howard, you're on.
Oh, good morning. How are you? I have a quick question. My wife, every year she gets thermography to check her breast to see if there's any growth growing. Is the hospital using any thermography at all that you know of?
Is that correct?
Say it again, Dr. Olds.
That was thermography, is
correct.
That correct?
Correct.
Okay. So thermography hasn't actually been approved by the FDA, although there are places that provide it as a service. I think it's probably safe to say that that's useful as perhaps an adjunct, but it does not replace the need for routine mammography because it's entirely based on thermographic signaling, so heat signatures. And again, it's just not approved by the FDA, so I would be hesitant to say that that should replace mammography as a screening tool.
Well, Howard, thank you very much for the call. The number is 800-348-2551 on this Medical Monday. Renee is in Campbell Hall. Renee, go ahead.
Hi. My husband has metastatic prostate cancer, stage 4. He's got mets in his ribs and in his lumbar spine. He doesn't seem to be able to be tolerating the pain management pharmaceuticals well. So the next stage, I understand, is to use radiation on the mets. And also there's lymph nodes that are also going on with the mets, metastatic. So the question is radiation is like a negative. For my husband, it's a negative. So is radiation on the mets really very bad? And is there any what would be the negative? How it could hurt his body having radiation like that?
Okay. So I think probably the easier way to answer this is to talk about the positives, because it has a real chance of perhaps alleviating his discomfort and pain in those sites. That's certainly not a guarantee, but there's a good chance that that could help. The downsides, there's a potential that it could decrease blood counts to some degree. Again, I don't know his full medical history by any means, so that would largely have to do with how much has to be radiated. Those are kind of the downsides in a general way of considering this with the information you gave me.
I'll give you more information if you ask me what you need.
We have another minute here, Renee. Go ahead. You can do that.
I don't know what kind of questions do you, I'm like, they're at like 3 or 4 millimeters large. There's a couple in the ribs. His pain is, he has pain. He will not respond to pain medication because of other issues that he has with his health. So my question is, is it a balance of, yes, you should have the radiation to help for the pain, but it's a balance because that kind of radiation is not necessarily good to have?
So I guess the qualification of good versus bad is very arbitrary. Because these are focal areas that need to be treated, I don't think this is going to be a significant downside for him. I don't see this as a real potential for causing late effects, but again, I'm being very cautious in that because, again, I don't know exactly what areas need to be irradiated, what the volume of that area or areas is, because those things can really, you know, modify your treatment and your treatment recommendations. While you don't want to think about it, radiation as being good, it does have a role for palliating someone's symptoms who's having pain, particularly when they are not tolerating pain medications very well. So I think the simple answer is to perhaps go to speak with a radiation oncologist and essentially get a piece of paper and write down the pros and the cons of the treatment that's being recommended. If there are more pros on that list, then I think you have your answer.
Renee, thank you very much for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Tia Olds joins us today, and Patrick is in Voorheesville. Hello, Patrick, you're on.
Hello. I have a little bit of an offbeat question.
Oh, terrific.
I've been reading a bit of research in the scientific community about the relationship between fungus and kind of acting more as a proactive supplement to prevent these types of things. And I was curious if you had any input as to how that might be able to help or if it does at all.
Fungus. Okay. Dr. Olds.
Okay. So fungus among us. I couldn't resist. Sorry, Ray.
<It's fine>.
So I guess my question for you is, do you mean fungus in terms of fighting cancer or prevention of cancer?
I've read that, and I'm not sure if I've read also in chemotherapy, like helping with the effects. I'm not sure if you've come across that or if that's something that's kind of not totally true.
So, not having read what you've read, you know, there is something called a microbiome. So that's kind of the microorganisms that are in your gut, essentially. So we know that probiotics, which, you know, you've heard a lot about over the last 10, 15 years, I would guess, can do a lot to improve the microbiome and make sure that you have more good bacteria than bad bacteria. So that can improve gastrointestinal symptoms for people that have issues with chronic constipation, diarrhea, or, you know, alternating between the two. So they're, I would think, is some real benefit potentially to balancing that environment when someone is having chemotherapy, even radiation therapy, to make sure that you have that balance to help minimize some of the gastrointestinal toxicities.
Okay. Patrick?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Tia Olds joins us today on this Medical Monday. Louise is in Schenectady. Louise.
Oh, doctor, I would like to ask, how common is it to get pneumonitis following treatment for lung cancer?
Yes. Oh, okay. So I would say it depends on the lung function prior to the treatment. So if someone has a lot of changes related to emphysema or fibrosis because they've been exposed to different chemicals, asbestos, the like, their chance of developing pneumonitis after radiation therapy and indeed with some systemic therapies as well, that increases the risk. If you have a large tumor that's being treated in the lung, that increases the risk as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you
You're
very
welcome.
Much, doctor.
You're quite welcome.
Louise, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number on Medical Monday. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Nick in Liberty, New York is next. Nick, you're on.
Hello. I have a friend of mine who is a singer and developed throat cancer, and after his radiation therapy, his voice has never been the same. Is there a chance that that voice could eventually develop into a singing voice again? What is there other kind of therapy we could follow up on?
So the change in voice quality after radiation is something that certainly can happen. It might be worthwhile for your friend to go and see a speech pathologist. They may be able to help him just kind of reorient his voice and perhaps use it in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Speech pathologist. And that's about it. There's no procedures that could help. Because I don't know if it's specifically the vocal cords, or is the vocal cords considered the throat?
Well, you know, starting with the speech
Exactly.
Sure. starting with the speech pathologist, he or she would actually do some testing. So they would get a chance
to see what
the abnormality is. Yeah, and they would be able to localize it and then figure out, hey, does this require some type of injection, like Botox for some people? Does this require a different type of procedure, or is this a matter of retraining that person to use their vocal cords in a slightly different way?
Well, it's certainly worth pursuing. All right, Doctor, I thank you all so very much, and have a good day. And both of you, have a nice life. Everyone, have a nice life.
Hey, you too,
bye.
Nick. Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. Dr. Tia Olds joins us today. Dr. Olds is a board-certified radiation oncologist at New York Oncology Hematology. This email from Nancy in Little Falls. Nancy writes, I have a 39-year-old male friend who's being treated for pancreatic cancer at University of Louisville, Kentucky. He had a long chemo treatment last week and had to wear a halter for 48 hours for continued treatment at home. Is this usual? Pancreatic cancer has only a 9% five-year survival rate. Suggestions or comments for us? And where should the public direct cancer research funds if the overall survival rate has not changed in centuries? I want my 8-year-old nephew to have a living father, and that's from Nancy in Little Falls.
Okay. The halter monitor, I'm not sure that that's not something I've commonly heard of after someone receiving chemotherapy, so I don't have any information on that. In terms of the high mortality rate for pancreatic cancer, it continues to be high. She's absolutely right about that, and it's disappointing. There's certainly research that is ongoing to look and see if there are different ways to be a little bit more effective in treating the cancers. Unfortunately, these are often diagnosed at late stages, which makes treatment difficult, curative treatment difficult.
You know, it occurs to me that there are simple tests you can have for some cancers, and there, you know, even a blood test might catch something. Why is it that pancreatic cancer is one that people always arrive very late in the game?
Mainly because of where it's situated in the body, you tend to have a lot of potential for growth of the cancer before you actually have symptoms. Painless jaundice is one of the symptoms that you find with people who have pancreatic cancer toward what we call the head of the pancreas, and that's kind of where it intersects the duodenum. In terms of having something that can be used as a screening tool, that's a blood test, for instance, we just don't have anything at this time that gives us information about early stage pancreatic cancer. Some enzymes are used to follow someone once they've been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer that gives you a sense of whether or not the disease is increasing or decreasing. But we found that those blood tests are not specific enough to give you information on early stage disease, meaning that you can't just test 100 people by doing that blood test and be able to detect a reasonable amount of people who actually have an early stage cancer. It's just not that sensitive or specific for that.
Dr. Tia Olds joins us today. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. Susan in West Tockbridge. Susan, you're on.
Hi. Thank you very much. I just turned 78, and I came in the program when I heard you talking about the thermography. I have had, maybe 20 mammographies. I have had thermography. I always went to New York to the exact same place, but I don't want to travel now because of the COVID. I'm thinking of whether I could maybe just go for a sonogram or maybe forget the whole thing because of my age. I am on a very low-dose estrogen patch. I've had some calcium deposits, but year after year. Would you advise me to forget it, just go for the sonogram, or maybe get it up here in the Berkshires, or maybe even in Albany? What would be your feeling about that?
I think it's worthwhile to continue doing screening mammography, particularly since you are still utilizing exogenous estrogens. It's important. The biggest risk factor for the development of breast cancer is age. So I think it's a bit of a misrepresentation to think, well, I'm a certain age and I don't need to do this anymore. That's not exactly true. I think doing a screening mammogram is still something that you would benefit from.
Not just the sonogram.
No, and I was actually going to say, thank you for that. The mammogram can sometimes be complemented with doing ultrasonography, just if there's some area that needs to be investigated a little bit more fully, particularly in the case of someone with dense breast tissue. Ultrasonography can really augment that.
I have dense breast tissue, but is it going to screw it up if I don't go? I mean, I'm not going to go into New York, so I would do it maybe at Berkshire Medical Center. Is there going to be a big difference? And maybe they won't have seen the calcium deposits year after year after year, so they won't know it's that. Am I hurting myself by going up here?
I don't have a reason to think that you are. I obviously am not familiar with the equipment or the location, but I would guess that there's modern equipment there, and I don't have a reason to think that going there would put you at a disadvantage. You can always let whatever imaging facility you're going to know where your prior images were done because they can request them. So that comparison is very helpful.
Susan, thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Tia Olds joins us today. Here's a hypothetical question for you, Dr. Olds. If humans were to live long enough, if we were all not killed by something else, would we all eventually get cancer? In other words, if I live to 125, am I going to drop dead of cancer?
You'll be gone at 110 because of renal failure, but I suppose there's a chance that you would probably develop a malignancy at some point.
But you don't think everyone? In other words, Bob Dole, 97 years old, announces he has advanced stage lung cancer.
Yes.
I mean, is it going to hit everybody if you live long enough?
That is possible. That is possible. I've never thought about it, but I think that's possible.
Well,
particularly prostate and breast cancer.
You know, that's the sort of optimism I bring to the show every day. Let's go to Ann in West Stockbridge. Ann, you're on.
Oh, hi. I just was listening to the woman from West Stockbridge who was asking about places around here to go to. And Fairview and Great Barrington is a great hospital, and they do great mammograms, and they have the sonography, or they can do it also. And it's easier and closer than BMC. So that was one. But I also wanted to just mention the guy who called about the mushrooms and treating cancer.
Mm-hmm.
There's a man named Paul Stamets. It's Stamets. And he's the mushroom guru. And he swears he cured his mother's fourth stage breast cancer using medicinal mushrooms. And he...
Huh.
So... If that guy wants to explore it more, or if you're interested, it's pretty interesting stuff.
Hmm.
And so anyways, I just wanted to share that with you.
Thanks a lot. What's the guy's name again?
It's Paul, and it's S-T-A-M as in man, E-T-S.
Interesting. Well, there you go. And thanks a lot for that one, Dr. Tia Olds. I hope that you can hang on the line here for a moment. We'll take a quick break. 800-348-2551 is our number. Board-certified radiation oncologist Tia Olds joins us, and we'll be back with more of your calls and emails coming up. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Dr. Tia Olds joins us from New York Oncology Hematology. And Dr. Olds, this email came in from Trish in Lee, Massachusetts. Trish writes, "It was recommended after my last mammogram to come back in 6 months for another, as there was a spot they were looking at. I've always had dense breasts. I always had the ultrasound. But my question is it safe to have mammograms in 6 months? I'm 68, and that's from Trish in Lee, Massachusetts."
So I'm going to say that is probably safe. They're going to likely do limited views since they have something in mind that they're looking to investigate. So I don't think that there's a great concern regarding that. I think that should be safe.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. And Bob is in New Marlborough, Massachusetts. Bob, you're up.
Hi, I'm 42 years old. I went through about a 15-year period of breaking many bones and then a history of kidney stones, and I've had probably an upwards of 10 CAT scans and then uncountable amount of x-rays of various body parts, and I just wondered what that's done for my future cancer risk and if there's anything I can do to prevent any future problems or what I could look out for.
Okay. So that's more of a diagnostic radiology question. There's some sophisticated calculators that clinicians have access to kind of quantify total dose to regions. And radiologists, diagnostic radiologists, have the ability to come up with those numbers. Again, that's out of my field of expertise.
Okay.
Sure. All right, Bob, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Tia Olds joins us on the program today on this Medical Monday. We go to Judy in Williamstown. Judy, you're on. Hello.
Hello. I had endometrial cancer about 14 years ago. It was stage 3, and I had surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. Since that time, I've developed incontinence. And it's gone from occasional to continuous or practically every day. And I'm wondering if the radiation has damaged the pelvic area. What can you say about that?
Did you have a hysterectomy prior to treatment or as part of the treatment?
As part of the treatment?
Yes. So it's going to be really hard to know what contributed to your incontinence because it's multifactorial. All of those things could potentially have contributed to it. I think it's worthwhile, if you haven't already done this, to actually go to a genital urologist. That feels like a term I just made up, but to go to a urologist that would actually have specialization in incontinence for women. And they can perhaps get to the bottom of what's going on with you and maybe be able to provide some assistance.
Okay, Judy?
Okay, but I'm just wondering, does radiation damage the cells afterwards? Could that be what's going on?
Well, certainly it could contribute, but the fact that you've actually had a large organ removed, the uterus removed, that in itself, if you look at women who've had hysterectomies and they didn't have cancer, they didn't have chemotherapy or radiation therapy after that, they have a higher risk of incontinence. So that's what I mean. It's multifactorial. It's really hard to know what is causing your incontinence. Does that make sense?
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Judy. Dr. Tia Olds joins us on Medical Monday today, and let's go to the Colony, New York. And, Jean, you're on.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to, it's more of a statement than, you know, a question. As I said to the gentleman who answered the phone, when I was a young child, I received a number of chest x-rays, like I think most people did back then. I had a parent who had tuberculosis, and so they were checking, you know, the family. I'm telling you, it was weekly. And so a few years back, I wound up at Dana-Farber, and I wound up having 2/3 of my thyroid removed at that time. And as a result of the radiation, it had all calcified, and they had to scrape it all. But it was from the x-rays, you know, as a child. So during the intervening years, no one was really advocating, like when you went to the dentist or no matter what you were doing, you know, going to the dentist, no matter what type of surgery that you should, you know, when you're having x-rays, make sure you had the shield on. Obviously, after I had my surgery, you can be sure my children, when they go to the dentist or have anything done, we have to protect ourselves. As good as the, you know, I mean, we all, radiation is certainly a necessary evil, but there's still danger out there.
Jean, thank you very much. Without question. But operating procedures have changed, and the amount of radiation has changed as well.
That is true. Again, we're prisoners of our own time period and knowledge base, so we're able to function with what we know and not so much of what we don't know. So certainly X-rays 30, 40, 50 years ago, we're talking about much higher utilization. The energies were different, so you certainly had a lot more penetration to organs like the thyroid. You didn't have those areas being covered when you had people going for X-rays. People that were in the U.S. military around the 50s and 60s, some of their children would receive low-dose radiation therapy to their face to deal with acne. Enlarged thymus glands were treated with radiation. So there's certainly a historic lesson to be learned and mistakes that have been made out of ignorance that we are desperately trying not to repeat.
This is from Mary in Springfield, and then we'll go back to the phones. Mary writes, I have a suspected thyroid cancer and have an issue with the radioactive iodine treatment, being anaphylactically allergic to iodine. How does it affect treatment if one cannot take iodine? And that is from Mary in Springfield.
That is an excellent question. And unfortunately, that's also not my my specialty. That's probably going to be more nuclear medicine, because that tends to be the professional that administers those treatments, at least in this part of the country. I don't know what the alternative would be, but it's a good question, and you definitely should pass that on to your clinician, because you're going to have to figure out what the next step in treatment is going to be, because the anaphylactic reaction is certainly nothing to discount for obvious reasons.
Dr. Tia Olds joins us, and back to the phones we go. Pat is in Niskayuna. Hiya, Pat. You're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Hi. Yes, I had a mastectomy with lymph gland removed, and I've been retaining a lot of fluid. It usually ranges from about 3 to 8 pounds. And I want to know... if you can tell me something that might help remove the toxins and the fluids from my body. I searched 4 or 5 books, and they're not providing me very much information. And when I told my oncologist about it, she said I should talk to my primary doctor. And I asked her, why would I talk to him? I said, he's never even examined my breast. I said, so why would you send me there? And she says, well, I can't help you.
So question for you, where's the fluid accumulating? Is it accumulating in that arm on the side where you had the mastectomy?
It's all over. It's the hands, the knees. And each morning I wake up, I look at my hands, and I can tell what the rest of my body is like and how careful I must be, because sometimes I can barely bend my knees.
Okay. So my guess is the reason the oncologist is sending you back to your primary physician, because that diffuse swelling is unlikely to be related to the mastectomy and breast cancer that you had. There could be something else going on. You could be retaining fluid as a function of some changes with the heart's ability to return that fluid to where it should go. It could also be related to your kidneys. Perhaps they're not working as well as they have in the past, so that fluid is being retained.
Okay, because I already talked to the doctor about the heart. I was having palpitations, and I was left on my own, and I really didn't know who to contact, but I didn't get any help from the office. So what was the other one? Cardiologist, and who? What was the other one?
A nephrologist, a kidney specialist.
Right. Okay. All right. Okay, I will do that.
All right, Pat, okay. And I think we're going to have a nephrologist on here in the next week or two, so listen for that. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Lianne in Hyde Park, you're on.
Hello. I'm driving. Hopefully the noise in the car isn't annoying.
It's okay.
I have a question about, so you mentioned before about not stopping mammography, et cetera, when patients are elderly. But we did stop bringing my mother for, you know, colonoscopies and mammography when she turned 100 5 years ago. Should she be continuing?
So I would say it's reasonable to consider not proceeding with colonoscopies, partially out of the fear that you could actually result in some perforation there just because of her advanced age. Mammography is certainly something that could be considered to be discontinued. I would suggest she continue to get yearly physical examinations to detect any changes that are there. So that's a discussion between you and your mother's doctor to see what the utility would be of continuing those examinations.
Okay, I mean, is that common to stop, discontinue at some point when they get to that type of age range?
And the maybe the larger question or answer is, if you find something, what is the ability to actually treat it?
Right.
If something,
I mean, she has no
something,
high blood pressure,
yeah.
No high cholesterol, nothing like that. You know, she's healthy. She's always been tiny. She's, 98 pounds, 105 feet tall type of thing.
And she's 105 years old, Lyanne?
Almost 105. She'll be 105 in April.
Good Lord. Well,
something
amazing. In the water down there. Hey, that's great. Hang in there.
Yeah. So even with being in good health, you still want to consider the fact that people in that particular age group are going to be very sensitive to anesthesia if there's an operative procedure that has to be handled.
Right.
So there's some things that have to be considered. Two steps past.
I mean, we
if
definitely
you
have a familial sensitivity to medication.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Lyanne, that's 105. That is amazing. What's the oldest patient you've treated, Dr. Olds?
Let's see. 94?
94 is up there as well. But
I
didn't even think that many people made it to 105. It's incredible. Kathy in Newburgh. Kathy, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling with a similar question, I guess, to some of your other callers. I had breast cancer about 20 years ago, and ever since then, after I had the radiation and the chemo, I've been getting regular mammographies and ultrasound, and they wanted to kind of increase the occurrence of the mammographies, and I keep thinking, if I do this every year for the past 20 years and for the next 20 years, what's the chance that the radiation from the mammography is going to trigger more cancer?
Okay.
I'm not qualified to exactly answer that question because it's more of a diagnostic radiology question. Certainly you want to ask, why do they want to increase the frequency? Is there an alternative to increasing the frequency? If they're looking at dense breast tissue, is there a chance that you could alternate mammography with MRIs? Because that would cut back on the total amount of radiation you're receiving to the breast for imaging, because MRIs don't use radiation. So those are some of the questions you may want to ask.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Kathy, you're welcome.
Thank you. Now we go to lovely Mount Kisco, New York. Richard, you're on.
Hello.
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 A question about lung cancer. I have a mass in my right lung, upper right lobe, which is currently being evaluated. I'm a very fragile patient, so I'm told that they really would not want to do surgery on me with general anesthesia, and that instead they would use radiology if it becomes necessary to treat me. I'm told that radiology these days is almost as effective as surgery, like maybe 80% instead of 90%. And I'm wondering what you feel about that, how successful radiology without surgery is these days.
So it depends on the illness that's being treated. If you're talking about a relatively small cancer in the lung that doesn't have any involvement in the lymph nodes and hasn't spread outside of the chest.
That's true.
Yes. So considering that radiation to that area, and it's a special type of radiation, so it's a high-dose type of radiation, is certainly a reasonable choice when surgery is not something that would be feasible or you decline surgery.
Would you say it's nearly as effective these days, or is that really not true?
So I would say surgery is still the gold standard for early stage lung cancer,
right.
Again, without lymph nodes and the other things we discussed. But radiation is certainly a reasonable alternative with good results in terms of being disease-free at that site. So it's a consideration.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Richard, thank you very much. Now, we only have about a minute here with Dr. Tia Olds, but we'll try to get one more question in. This usually backfires on me. Tom in Hillsdale, can you make it quick?
Sure.
Okay, you're on.
All right. Just quickly, wife was diagnosed with early-stage breast cancer, did a lumpectomy. That was October 30th. She had some complications, internal bleeding. So we are just going to be starting chemo, or not chemo, radiation now. She's actually missed chemo, just go right to radiation. But is that such a long period in between? Is the chemo or radiation even going to help at this point?
And again, can you tell me when the surgery was?
October 30th.
October 30th. So I would say that there is some magnitude of benefit to doing the radiation even this far out. What the magnitude is, I think it's hard to ascertain, but the benefit certainly isn't zero.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Well, Dr. Tia Olds, we are just about done here, and it has been fun having you back once again, and hopefully we will talk soon. How do people find New York Oncology Hematology on the web?
Well, they go to newyorkoncology.com, and it's a fairly user-friendly website. We have information about our providers, diseases that are treated, as well as clinical trials and research.
Well, terrific, and thank you so much once again. We will talk to you soon. Support comes from Columbia Memorial Health. Open, adhere for the health and safety of their patients at all of their care centers, following the CDC's standard for cleaning and screening all patients and staff, ColumbiaMemorialHealth.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Tia Olds of New York Oncology Hematology for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the calls and emails. Sorry if we didn't get to yours. We'll do it again. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Joe Makowicz took the calls. Our producers, Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we'll talk about real estate and buildings and back lots, and some of them might have makeshift cemeteries. We've had that on the program. There's a lot of interesting things when you talk about real estate. Trust me, I'm not making it up. Join us tomorrow at 2 p.m. and find out if I'm lying. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.